The wounds of financial uncertainty are traditionally felt the most intensely by children. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Monday, July 19th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome financial therapist Rick Kaler for a conversation about financial trauma. How do we unpack our childhood experiences to better understand our money behavior today? Secretary Marsha Holtman leads the State Department of Labor and Regulation. We'll explore the data behind South Dakota's economic recovery after the height of pandemic disruption. SDPB's Jackie Hendry recaps this weekend's events in Rosebud, and we meet artist Vanessa Frank. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. The lifting of a federal freeze on evictions at the end of July has raised concerns that thousands of South Dakota renters could find themselves in danger of being booted from their homes. The state set aside $200 million to help with the outstanding rent, utility payments, and other expenses, but a tenant advocate says not enough people know about the assistance. Making a difficult situation worse, people who are evicted would be left to find new homes in a tightening South Dakota rental market. There has been a run on affordable housing during the pandemic, putting a further strain on renters. South Dakota's two U.S. senators oppose a push by the Senate Majority Leader to decriminalize marijuana. That's despite the Senate leader pointing to the state as a reason the chamber could make the policy change. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says South Dakota offers a litmus test for how attitudes towards cannabis have changed.
Even South Dakota, one of the most conservative states in America, a majority voted to legalize adult recreational use of marijuana.
55% of state residents voted for Amendment A. The ballot measure legalized adult use and medical marijuana, as well as industrial hemp, into the state constitution. Schumer, a Democrat from New York, has drafted legislation to decriminalize marijuana at the federal level. It would leave states to decide whether to legalize the drug. But South Dakota's two Republican senators are not keen on the idea. Mike Round says he thinks decriminalizing marijuana is wrong.
The concept itself is something that I'm not in favor of. I most certainly will not be supporting a plan to decriminalize marijuana. I don't think it's the right thing to do. I think it sends the wrong message to our youth. I think we've got enough problems with gateway drugs the way that it is right now.
Rounds' colleague in the Senate, John Thune, is also against decriminalizing marijuana at the federal level. Amendment A was supposed to go into effect on July 1st, but has been held up in the state courts over whether the measure is constitutional. A state legislative subcommittee is on hold, waiting to write legislation that will regulate cannabis use. In the event the state Supreme Court finds Amendment A unconstitutional, the group behind the proposal has four ballot questions ready for the 2020 election. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
57% of South Dakotans 12 and older are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, but health officials are aiming for 70%. Vaccination rates have slowed in the state. There is hesitancy about the vaccine, particularly in rural communities. Kim Malzum-Risden is the state's Secretary of Health. She hopes an increase in access points can help.
The ways you can make vaccinations most convenient is to couple it with things that people are already doing. So if you're going to a pharmacy, let's say, for other reasons, and it's easy to get a shot there. The other thing that we've seen come into being is the ability for people to get shots at their doctor's office.
Malzum-Risden says a vaccination is the most effective way to protect yourself and others from the coronavirus. She says it's particularly important now since the state has reported three cases of the highly contagious Delta variant. The strain of the virus is primarily spread and contracted by unvaccinated people. Go to covid.sd.gov for more information on where to get vaccinated in your area. Today's weather report shows highs in the upper 80s in the east and in the mid-90s in the west, with mostly sunny skies. Tonight, it will be mostly clear in the 70s. Tomorrow, the highs will be in the 90s across the state, so make sure to drink lots of water. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota is at the height of visitor season. Europe is opening up. And the motorcycle rally at Sturgis is only weeks away. Well, what does our COVID picture look like as we gather and celebrate and welcome people from around the world? Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health. He's joining us in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Dr. Kura, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. Pleasure.
Drink lots of water is probably a good thing to remind people as well for their overall health. I want to go back and talk about some basic things about minimal community spread and moderate community spread, because we're looking at the counties around the Sturgis area and in Pennington County, Lawrence County, Butte County, Meade County, and we're seeing the words moderate spread. But the relative case numbers, active cases in Meade County, that's 6 people. In Pennington County, that's 60. Help us understand the relevance of moderate spread in these counties when the actual active case number is seems to me pretty low.
Yeah, and the great point, epidemiologically speaking, you know, anytime you say it's greater than 3% of positive tests, you're already in the moderate category. So the number, the actual raw number of cases is one way of looking at it, but the more informative way of looking at it is what's the percentage of positive tests that you have in any given county or state.
All right. So are people not getting tested? Do we have tests available? Are we just kind of thinking we have colds and allergies now and forgetting that we could have something far worse?
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's always a worry when you talk about positive test rates. For the state, it's around 7%. Maybe for the county, it's around the same. Is there a secret or what we call, in epidemiologically speaking, crypto spread of the infection that we are not aware of? The only way you can do that is to do random sampling of a good percentage of the community. But not given that, we just have to go with what we know, and that 6 to 7% is still, despite not testing, say mass testing, that's quite an alarming number.
All right. So we think there are many more cases than are being reported is the bottom line here.
Yeah, and that's always the worry and concern. And the only way to validate if what we are assuming to be far worse than peers is to do mass random sampling.
Okay, so people are getting ready for the motorcycle rally. It seems last year there was debate and controversy about whether this was a super spreader event because that we just didn't have the data at the time. It was very political, of course. What do we know this year about last year's Sturgis gathering? Do we know anything now from a scientific standpoint, not from a political standpoint?
Yeah, from the data and the science, it's very clear. You know, anytime you have a mass gathering event, and it's not just the rally, even the fact that we are a tourist state, especially the west side of the state, we can expect as well of the population that arrives here from various states and even internationally, those are going to be also a risk for the spread of this disease. Beginning of June in the Netherlands, they did a case control study of an event that was meant to study exactly what we're talking about. They had a music concert, attended by tens of thousands of people, and then they realized that it caused spread of several thousand. What we do know, without any doubt, is when you have a mass gathering event, whether it be indoors or outdoors, there's a risk. The risk varies more if it's indoors. Now, with the Sturgis Rally, as much as it's outdoors, folks have to use the facilities for food, for drinks, for restroom breaks, and that's where the risk is the highest.
Yeah, and that's an incredibly crowded space for people who have been out there. Is the challenge access? As Secretary Melson Risden said, you know, we need to tie this. You're already going to your doctor for your annual checkup. You're already at the pharmacy for some other medication. Are we talking access? Are we talking more messaging? What do you think would move the needle as far as people saying yes to the vaccine?
Yeah, and this is an age-old public health issue and challenge. We've seen it with polio when we started early, to get folks to get vaccinated. you needed a concerted effort from public figures, and overall, acceptance is only possible when you have large groups of people of varying age groups, varying identities, going out and spreading the message. That's one. But I think the bigger challenge we face today is access, because people will, if given at the site where they are working, interacting, just say, okay, I'll get the shot, rather than actually make an attempt to get out, find the time, go to a place and get vaccinated. So it's a mixture of both.
Yeah. Is there any value to sort of pop-up sites like you see at Mobile Blood Bank? You know, can you take a truck to the rodeo and have, or is that proven to be just like, that's not what people are going to do?
Yeah, that will bring in some. It's not going to be a big game changer. I think the real game changer is right at the workplace, and especially those frontline workers who have a hard time finding time off to go get vaccinated.
Yeah. Anything else that you want people to think about now regarding COVID? We were just listening a few minutes ago to this idea of a pandemic. No, it's going to be an all things considered, a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Is that fair to say that we could be looking at a, in quotations, pandemic of the unvaccinated next?
Yeah, and actually we are seeing exactly that. If you look at the numbers from the CDC, everyone who has gotten COVID-19 currently, we're looking at 95% of the folks who get the disease are unvaccinated. 97% that get hospitalized are unvaccinated, and 98% of deaths are those that are unvaccinated. So the numbers are clear. Like you said, it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. We have a solution. We have a one simple way to end this, and that's get vaccinated.
Yeah, preventable deaths largely. Dr. Shankar Kura, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori.
Ahead on the program, the state's low unemployment rate remains steady. Secretary of the Department of Labor, Marsha Hultman, is with us. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Miss something on SDPB? Sign up for the SDPB Morning Report. Get the reporting you love straight to your email twice a week. Go more in depth with our statewide coverage, and don't miss critical segments from shows like In the Moment and South Dakota Focus. It's the news you can use, free from clutter, and best of all, free of charge. To sign up for the Morning Report, visit sdpb.org/news and scroll to the bottom.
Program funding is provided by Acupuncture for Health, relieving chronic pain and arthritis symptoms. Clinics in Rapid City and Custer. Acupuncture for Health, serving the Black Hills since 2003.
SDPB's Fiddles and Friends returns this August with 3 live concerts. Enjoy music from talented fiddlers including Kenny Putnam, Tom Schaefer, and Owen DeYoung. Join us in Watertown on August 26th, Sioux Falls on August 27th, or on August 28th in Rapid City. Help support SDPB and get your tickets today by going to sdpb.org/fiddles. Sponsored by Crisp Row Hospitality and First Bank and Trust.
SDPB covers issues of diversity and minority affairs, from Native Americans to recent immigrants. Support for SDPB's diversity reporting comes from the Rapid City Rotary Club through the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. In a recent statewide survey conducted by SDPB in partnership with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Coming Home Initiative, respondents were asked to report their economic expectations for the next 5 years. Would their families be better off, worse off, about the same? Well, nearly 20% said they were unsure, and that's perhaps an expected response during a pandemic. But notably, fewer than 25% of respondents said they expected to be better off 5 years from now. Meanwhile, the South Dakota labor market has been rebounding quickly from the height of pandemic disruption. The state has one of the lowest number of unemployed people in the nation. Should we be feeling a little more optimistic about the economic future? Are there other factors at play? We're going to explore how to overcome the emotions of financial disruption in a moment with financial therapist Rick Kaler. But first, Marcia Haltman is South Dakota's Secretary of the Department of Labor and Regulation. And Secretary Haltman is going to join us with a look at the data. Secretary Haltman, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Lori, for this opportunity.
Tell me a little bit about where we're at from a labor market perspective, unemployment, and so forth. What are you tracking, and what do you think some of the significant numbers are?
Some of the key indicators that we always look at are our total workforce participation. And that number has grown since May of 2020. So we have increased by 11,300 participants in the workforce. So that's good. That's showing that individuals are getting back into the workforce, maybe after a long absence or maybe a short term during the pandemic. And as you mentioned, we do continue to have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation. And that number is an indicator of individuals who have been actively searching for work. So we did see a slight uptick to 2.9 on the recent release. But again, that's very low, and we're one of the lowest in the nation at that 2.9% rate.
How do we measure the impact or the potential impact or lack of impact of the end of the supplemental employment benefit from the federal government?
So South Dakota did end those benefits on the 26th of June, and I think there was a little misperception about how many people that was keeping out of the workforce. So I will tell you that we had approximately 1,500 individuals that were receiving just the federal benefit. And so when those programs ended, those benefits ended for those individuals. Then we have another about 3,000 individuals that qualify for a state benefit, and from week to week, they're most likely going to continue to qualify for that state benefit, but the benefit amount was reduced by $300 a week when the federal benefits ended. So definitely not the numbers that we saw during the pandemic. We had seen those greatly reduced even prior to those pandemic unemployment insurance benefits ending.
Yeah. We're hearing about a massive shift in employment, people leaving jobs and going to other jobs, just people throwing up their hands and saying, I want more, I want less, I want different. Any way to measure that? What are we seeing as far as transfer of an employment? Is that something that you have insight into?
It's a little bit early to analyze that. Much of our data is going to be delayed by about 6 months, and that just has to do with reporting and one-wage reports and things like that come into the department. I can tell you, too, anecdotally, I think there is much of that going on. I think there's been some hesitancy for individuals to return to certain occupations and definitely an interest in pursuing other options. That's one thing the department does. We have training programs for individuals that maybe need upskilled or reskilled, and there's been increased interest in those as well, just indicating that individuals are looking maybe for some more security that comes with a higher skilled job.
Yeah. So what is, this might be anecdotal as well, but let me know if it's, is there advice on what's working to bring employees into your industry and what's not working? Any thoughts there?
Yes. There are some really simple things employers can do, and sometimes they're hesitant to do them. But one is to actually list the wage that they are offering. And I think you see more and more of that, even just driving around town, maybe on a help wanted sign. But studies show, and our own data shows in our system, that a job opening with a wage listed will get twice as much attention as an opening that does not include that. And so it's just a good way at a base level to get more attention drawn to your job opening. And we've really encouraged employers, and I believe we're seeing this happening too. So again, it's something we'll have a bit of a lag, but our youth participation rate in the workforce had lowered over the last couple of decades. I have a feeling we're going to see that uptick.
And another thing that's contributed to the issues and the workforce challenges that we're seeing today is so many individuals decided to retire maybe a little bit earlier than they would have during the pandemic. And so that created a lot of individuals leaving the workforce that maybe would have stuck on for a few more years. So how can we engage with both youth and retired folks, but at reduced hours? So maybe you get a couple great employees for 15 to 20 hours, and it takes two or three people to fill one position, but they're good, solid employees that will do a nice job for you.
Sure. And this might take a merging of data, but we know nationwide, of course, the number of deaths have impacted the workforce as well. Are you able to look at the number of people who died in South Dakota and find out if those are people in the workforce, if those are people who were already retired? Are we seeing an impact of death in the pandemic to filling open jobs?
You know, there certainly was an impact, and we've not looked at that data yet. I hate to make assumptions, but I know that our elderly population was greatly impacted the most in the death category. And so many of those individuals would not have been in the workforce any longer. But certainly we've all heard the stories, and that is something that we could look at, just kind of the age ranges and how many individuals that may have taken out of the workforce in South Dakota.
Yeah, I remember early on looking at the number of people who were infected and seeing a huge Gen X population, you know, and making the assumption or the hypothesis that perhaps it was, you know, these are the people who are working, but again, those are people who often went back to work as well. So it'd be interesting to know more about that. I'm also interested in knowing more about the women in the workforce, and that's also something that we don't track in South Dakota, whether women were more impacted by this than other states. Do I understand that correctly, or are there ways to look at how women have specifically been impacted, or how people of color have specifically been impacted by the disruption?
Again, we'll be able to rely on some national data when it comes out through the Census Bureau and some of those other surveys that are done. We anticipate that there was a slightly lessened impact in South Dakota just because our schools kind of did that hybrid or remained open model. In other states where you saw the greatest impact to women in the workforce, was when, as primary care providers, when schools were not open, then it had a tendency to hit women much harder as they stayed home to help with the education and care of children when their businesses were shut down.
Yeah. So as we were talking about what's good for children, we're also talking about how the impact on the workforce, even though sometimes, you know, and the openings or closings of daycares, it all sort of intersects. Fascinating stuff. If you're studying it 50 years from now, maybe not so fascinating if you're going through it. Anything else that you want to leave us with, Secretary Holtman, before we let you go for this month and maybe look at data in the future?
More than happy to come back and look at some of that data. The other area that will be interesting to study in the coming months is wages.
Sure.
And just what the impact has been to wages in South Dakota. Again, I anticipate that the data will show that wages have increased, and we'll be able to see to what extent that has happened.
Marsha Holtman is South Dakota's Secretary of the Department of Labor and Regulation. Thank you for being here with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, and we'll chat later.
Thanks. Ahead on the program, we'll talk about recovering from economic trauma with financial therapist Rick Kaler. And trauma isn't necessarily what you might think it is. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Akash Kapoor about utopias, the impulse to build a better world, and what happens when dreams crash against reality. He was raised in an experimental community in India, left for school in the U.S. at age 16, and later returned to raise his own family. His new book is Better to Have Gone, Love, Death, and the Quest for Utopia in Auroville. Join us.
Monday at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Shen Yun, presenting 5,000 Years of Civilization, combining ancient legends with technological innovations, historically authentic costumes and storytelling, August 3rd at the Monument in Rapid City. Tickets at shenyun.com.
Stay up to date with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Sign up for newsletters from SDPB. You can learn more about what's happening at our studios, get encapsulated news, see previews of specials, and so much more. SDPB in your inbox. Sign up online at sdpb.org.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at SDNCommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, the pandemic was emotional, disruptive, for many, traumatic. What does trauma have to do with money? What are some of the behavioral signs of financial trauma? What about the emotional signs? Rick Kaler is a pioneer in the field of financial therapy. He's the author of several books, a groundbreaking clinical study, and workshops in financial therapy. And he's joining us now in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City to talk about the complexities of financial trauma, including who it impacts the most. Rick, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Lori, good to be with you. This is an unusual experience being in studio after a year and a half of sequestering.
Here we are. And we knew it was coming, and here, you know, I think the world's kind of gone a little crazy as everybody adjusts to, I shouldn't use crazy as a term, but I mean, everything is a little discombobulated as people sit and try to adjust to new surroundings, don't you think? I've noticed
I was like, where's Lori? I can't hear her, and you do have to put on the headphones.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Remember those
now. I used to
now.
Know this. I used to know what all these buttons did in the studio. All right. What do we talk about when we're talking about trauma? When it comes to finances, people don't necessarily make the connection between that word and money.
Well, exactly. And I had a real hard time with connecting trauma, even with emotional trauma.
Yeah.
When I used to think of trauma, I thought it was really big events like a death or a murder or an accident or a life-threatening sickness. So for me to even get the idea that it was emotional was a little bit of a leap, which I think now today most people can absolutely connect emotional trauma because emotional trauma is associated with the physical trauma and often lasts much, much longer than the physical trauma. But financial trauma, that is a little bit harder one to connect, and yet it is everywhere in our lives.
Job loss, eviction, I'm trying to think of some of the big ones, homelessness or food insecurity. How big does the disruption have to be before you start seeing the behavioral or emotional impacts of it?
Yeah, so any of those, bankruptcy would certainly be in that. Something you might not think about would be an inheritance. Winning the lottery or a huge inheritance, that can be emotionally traumatic. So you can have these big events that can absolutely stay with a person and impact them for a long time. But you can also have a lot of small events, events that maybe you wouldn't associate with being traumatic. It could be struggling making a payment or even receiving a payment or receiving money. But when it's chronic, and it goes on and on and on, like any trauma, it depends upon the emotional impact, which, say, you could put on a scale of 1 to 10, how impactful it is. But then the frequency can make something that you'd rate a 2. If it just happened once, it's like no problem. Not every adversity is going to be traumatic.
Right.
But if you have something that's a 2 on the scale 1 to 10, but it happens every day for 10 years, that can become traumatic. They actually call that complex trauma. Mm. And it's really insidious because a bankruptcy, like I have a client who lost all of her savings as a kid. It disappeared. Mm-hmm. And we were able to connect it happened when her parents went into bankruptcy. But to her, her money disappeared. She had struggled saving. And it wasn't until she connected this as an 8-year-old that, wow, don't save money because it can disappear.
Because it can be gone, yeah.
And it wasn't even explained to her by the parents, honey, this is what happened to your money. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, she can remember that one experience, but something that happens over and over and over and over that's seemingly very little, for a kid, that's just the water I grew up in.
So
I'd like being a fish.
Right.
we better relate that to a fish.
If we could put ourselves in her parents' shoes, just, you know, from an imagination. So my question is, if we know that this can impact children, that we see the impacts of this mostly on children, maybe they were trying to protect her from the bankruptcy and figuring it out. But at the end, by not talking about it, they created this other sort of magical thinking of don't save, it might disappear. How much do we tell our kids about financial struggles, whether we have money, whether we don't, whether we're fighting about money, whether we're pretending not to fight about money? What, dealing with adults, what do you sort of wish some parents had known back then?
Yeah, that is a huge topic, Lori, because money is no talk. It's something mm-hmm. that families often don't talk about. And this would be a prime example. No, we're going to protect her. We don't want to tell her. We don't want to worry her that we're in bankruptcy and what all that means. So unfortunately, probably what they didn't intend was for their daughter to grow up with this idea that money can disappear.
Yeah.
You know, the interior rule that I use about talking to a child about money is that is this something that needs to be said to the child or to one of your adult friends?
Mm-hmm.
Because when it is sharing your fears in an inappropriate way or kind of venting on the child, all of your emotional baggage, that's when it can become harmful. But when it's presented as knowledge and it's presented as fact and without the emotional interpretation and the baggage that goes along with it, then it can be very healthy to let the child know what happened, because we all make up stories.
Yeah.
And a child's going to make up a story about why the money disappeared.
Yeah. You're going to explain it somehow, and you might explain it as, like, if I never save money, I will never lose money. I mean, that might be the explanation. Or I must save all the money in the world so that, you know, I never get stuck in that situation where our parents, we were living out of the car. Whatever your story is, a child might think, oh, if I'd been better, smarter, more prepared, I could have, you know.
Absolutely.
And the kid brings the piggy bank to the mom and dad and gives them a quarter and says, here, make it better. And, you know, you see this sort of heartache in families when they're struggling with finances. Ouch.
And for a child who bring it back to themselves and mm-hmm. put the onus and the shame on themselves, just like you said, that I should have known better. You know, a child also out of that could take away, if I'm going to save any money, it's going to be cash and it's going to be where I can see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, in adulthood, that doesn't serve us very well.
Right.
We can only stuff so much money under the mattress, even though today you're not losing anything putting money under the mattress. But the mattress can get lumpy.
Sure. Or my dad, I think I've told the story before, used to pat his, you know, left breast shirt pocket and say, I keep my investments right here as a joke, because that's where he, you know, kept his money clip with his cash in it. And, you know, I don't think he meant that in the way that I interpret it. But as a child, I meant you always must have that cash on you, and that's the only place for it. You know, you start telling yourself a story that so we know it's important to talk to our kids, to leave the emotion out of that and have those emotional conversations with other adults. Certainly there's a lot of resources right now during the pandemic, but what I want to talk to you about next is like, what if you don't know what, you know, like, how can you look at your own behavior and say, well, this is a strange thing that I do. I wonder where it's coming from. What are some of the things that you should notice and some of the questions that you might ask that would lead you to uncover some of this problematic behavior?
Right. Well, the first thing to do is to become curious about our behaviors. So many of our behaviors we are unaware of, right? We don't know that our behavior is not congruent with our values. We don't realize this behavior is unusual. For example, I can do math in my head real easy.
Yeah.
Most people can't. Yeah. Well, I just figure everybody can, right?
Sure.
It's not a problem. And so it comes down to the same thing with any money behavior, because most of these beliefs come to us when we're kids. Mm-hmm. We just adapt them. So it's first starting to be curious about when we're running into evidence that would suggest we have a problematic money behavior, or we have a money disorder like workaholism or gambling or hoarding, but problematic behaviors can be overspending and underspending. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many people who are underspenders think that that is an odd behavior that doesn't serve them well? Well, the money's in the bank, right?
Yeah, right.
But if you think about the function of money, it's to support our life, right? Uh-huh. Support what's important to us in life. And if we aren't spending it at some point in time, what good is it? Just, you know, think of Scrooge.
Yeah. Here's one that I think... you know, Rick and I get really real on this, and we tell our personal stories. But I remember early in my marriage doing a detailed budget, just really looking, you know, and I think my daughter had just been born and times were really tough. And I did this whole budget and I had to do the math all by hand because I didn't own a calculator. And this is before, you know, cell phones had calculators on them. I didn't even have a cell phone back then. And I got to the whole thing and I was going to budget for a calculator. And there wasn't enough money in the budget for a calculator. And I think for like 6 months, 6 years, I don't know, I refused to budget because it was like, well, what is the point? And at some point, you get to have to say to yourself, that's not my situation anymore. It's different now. Budgeting is different now than it was then. You won't get to the end and realize you have nothing because I'm doing better now than I was 25 years ago or what, you know, what have you. We got to grow up a little bit.
Yeah, and a great example of how life circumstances can change, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have all these money scripts and beliefs that we form as children. They work for us well at that time.
Yeah.
But then life changes, the play changes, and we continue on with the same script. And that's when the pain begins, is when we discover, wow, you know, I could have probably afforded a calculator five years ago. And and I did the same thing when the B-52 left Rapid City and the B-1s didn't come in for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I had some rentals. And if everything was full, I had to pony up $1,500 a month. And I just stopped looking at my balance sheet.
Yeah.
It's like, if I look, I'll get depressed and then I'll freeze. I've got to keep working. And it wasn't until 20 years later that I came to understand, oh, wow, I'm not $1,500 a month short anymore.
Yeah.
And haven't been for 18 years.
And that's the good news, too. The good news is facing these things can help you undo some of those things from your childhood and identify them, make a plan, and move on from it.
Yes,
fear
absolutely.
Not. Fear not to look at the balance sheet, even if it's so bad, because knowing is often better than not knowing.
Totally. So freeing when we can get a handle and we can actually go back and see where these things came from and resolve them.
Rick Kaler, yes. Financial therapist, author of Wired for Wealth and other books and programs on financial therapy. It is always a pleasure to sit with you and unpack some of these things, and hope that for our listeners, it helps them have some of those tough conversations, too. Hey, thank you for being here today.
And thank you, Lori. Always a pleasure.
Let's take a moment now for South Dakota history. On this day in 1964, a prehistoric archaeological site known as the Crow Creek Site is designated as a National Historic Landmark. It revealed a prehistoric community, a mass grave of more than 450 individuals, and an examination of policies regarding reburial of Native remains. The Crow Creek site is on the east bank of the Missouri River in Buffalo County. The site is managed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, but it's within the Crow Creek Reservation. The site had been known for many years prior to the designation, and some excavation had been done in the early 1950s. Excavation revealed evidence that ancestors of the Mandan people lived in the area beginning around 900 AD. There is evidence that ancestors of the Arikara people also inhabited the region beginning 1150. But study of the area also discovered some 483 individuals who were killed during an attack on the village in around 1325. The remains were found in a trench that was apparently being used as a line of defense for the village. Although the exact causes are unknown, study of the remains shows evidence of malnutrition, previous battle wounds to some, and almost all of the victims had been killed, mutilated, and scavenged before burial. There's environmental evidence from the period that overpopulation, land use patterns, and an unstable climate caused the people to compete for available farmland and other resources. There's a strong chance that several groups in the region attacked the Crow Creek village for its arable land. Before excavation of the site began, researchers agreed to the tribal council request that the remains stay within South Dakota for the entire period of study, and that after study, the remains should be reburied on the Crow Creek site, the place where the families had lived and died. At the request of the Arikara, the remains were placed in five burial vaults. The reburial took place in late summer, 1981. Several Christian ceremonies, a traditional Lakota ceremony, and a private Arikara ceremony were offered at the time. The Crow Creek site designated a National Historic Landmark on this date 57 years ago. Production help for this week in South Dakota history comes from Dr. Brad Tennant, professor of history at Presentation College. Ahead on the program, an emotional and historic homecoming, SDPB's Jackie Hendry reports on the repatriation of remains from the former Carlisle Indian Industrial School to the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Don Gagne. The pandemic has shifted a lot of things, and for many people, that includes what they wear and the way they engage with their clothes.
All of these changes in the workplace, in the way that we socialize, have really meant a sense of liberation for people to dress in a way that feels true to yourself.
Post-pandemic fashion. Next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Denny Menholt Toyota in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt Toyota. See you at Denny Menholt Toyota in Rapid City.
After more than a year of missed milestones and important moments shared over video, we at NPR are excited to celebrate our 50th anniversary with you. No special link required, and you don't have to be camera ready. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro. Thank you for sharing this special moment with us on the radio, online, wherever you listen. Celebrate every moment. Hear every voice.
SDPB, South Dakota's NPR station for 50 years.
Coffee, your alarm, another Monday morning. These things are a given. Getting news you can trust should be too. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this member station by name.
Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This weekend, the world watched as the remains of nine children who died at the former Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania were returned home to tribal land. SDPB's Jackie Hendry joins us now in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls with an update. Jackie, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
A very emotional story, a very emotional weekend. Where do you want to begin with this caravan that we watched really from Pennsylvania, from the transfer ceremony as it approached the original
home.
Yeah, home.
It's hard to know where to start. We caught up with the caravan on Friday as they made their way back to South Dakota and eventually to Mission on the Rosebud Reservation. We kind of first connected with them as they were making their way towards the Yankton tribe. They were kind of connecting with tribes along their way, especially as they made it through South Dakota. And it was really astounding to see, you know, the motorcycle escort, the caravan itself, and then just cars upon cars upon cars, almost as far as you could see, following and traveling with them. And people parked along all sorts of very rural roads all along the way, some of them holding signs. I saw one gentleman holding a feather. It looked like he was praying as the caravan went through. People showed up for miles to welcome these babies home, and it was really, really something to see.
Yeah. Prayer gathering. Let's talk a little bit about what happened once they cross into Otetishakawin land.
Yeah. So we our first stop was called the Whetstone Landing. This is just north of Bone Steel on the Missouri River. Before the Fort Randall Dam was downstream, this was actually part of the original kind of land base for the Rosebud Reservation. They chose that spot to bring the children and actually have them touch ground for the first time on this journey, because that area of the river was where those children were first put on steamboats about 140 years ago and then taken downstream to Sioux City, where they were put on trains. And so I do have a little bit of audio from Russell Eagle Bear. He's a tribal council representative, played a big role in kind of the mentorship of the young people that brought these children home and a big part of these events. And as the caravan was making its way towards Whetstone, he shared just a little bit of the history with the crowd that had gathered.
The first boarding school that was established in the United States of America was Carlisle. Very first boarding school. And now we're hearing stories of boarding schools here and there. There are many, many children out there that probably never came home. And I'm hoping and praying that this would be the first effort in finding out where our relatives are.
It was a very very spiritual gathering, honor songs sung while young men kind of carried these small boxes containing the remains of these children out of this trailer that had made this long journey from Carlisle and brought past a line of young women standing watching into a lodge that had been set up. And then in that lodge, the children were set down and put on the ground for the first time in 140 years. They were back home.
I want to talk a little bit about, you know, there's a drought in South Dakota, and yet there is this storm, and there is a rain. How has that weather event impacted the journey and really how it was perceived?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was, after the landing at Whetstone, the children were then taken to Syntyglashka University in Mission, where there was a wake and more prayer services the next day, and there was a storm that really, there hadn't been a big chance of rain. There was, I drove through the storm. I did not enjoy myself. I was scared. Yep. There was a whole lot of lightning, a whole lot going on. But the next morning, Dwayne Hollow Hornbear, who is a descendant of Friend Hollow Hornbear, who is one of the children brought home, he said this about the storm the night before.
Now, last night's rain wasn't even predicted. It came upon us so quickly, a healing, a cleansing. And going home, I looked up and I could see the children playing, just having a great time up there in the sky. bring such peace.
One more voice today from this weekend, Jackie. Who are we going to hear from?
We're going to hear from Ione Quigley. She's an elder. She's the Rosebud Tribe's historic preservation officer, and she's also a descendant of Alvin, or Kills Seven Horses, who is another one of the children who was brought home. She had the very important job of going to Carlisle and preparing these children to be buried in their traditional way and then to make this journey. And she talks about her kind of taking her first steps out into the cemetery at Carlisle.
The first day that I got there, I was walking up out the gate after I visited with them. And I heard a young lady say, "Wanahe." I turned around, but there was nobody. And so I started walking myself. And a little voice, I heard a little boy's voice say, "Ah, Wanahe, Wanta." So I turned around, but there was nobody. But I knew they knew I was there. And that's all they wanted, was grandma to comfort them. And I did.
No, Ione shared several stories ahead of the burial on Saturday that I'm hoping to share out kind of through the week. But especially thinking about how these children, they would have been punished if they spoke their indigenous languages in that setting. So to hear them acknowledge basically saying in Lakota, "She's here," and that a grandma came back for them.
Yeah. Jackie, we're going to leave it there. There's more coverage of this on sdpb.org/news, sdpb.org/spotlight. We're spotlighting some of these as such an important part of our history, emotional and not the end of the story by any means. Jackie, thank you.
Thanks.
The Dahl Art Center's Emerging Artist Series is featuring beautifully detailed drawings by recent Rapid City Stevens graduate Vanessa Frank. Frank began to take her drawing seriously when she was just in the eighth grade, and she works now mostly with charcoal pencils, pens, colored pencils. Frank won the Dahl's Best of the West exhibition and is joining us now in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Vanessa, welcome. Thank you so much for being here with us today, and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Not too many people get a solo exhibition at the Dahl Art Center at this point in their career. What does it mean to you to sort of have your work acknowledged in that way?
I definitely feel very blessed to be able to be in this. I got into this by like an email from my boyfriend's mother, who actually helped me get into this, which is crazy. But yeah, I have definitely gotten to where I was by so many days of practice. I wouldn't be here without like persevering in that, which I think has helped me a lot.
Since we're talking on the radio and people cannot see just the detail work that you do. I mean, imagine an architectural, you know, a rendering in pencil. Just you could stare and look at it forever at how the lines are formed and how you walk a line. Tell me a little bit about how you describe your art to other people.
Well, for my architecture ones, I just describe it as I take a photo from like Pinterest or something, and it's these Renaissance buildings is like my best way of describing how they look. They look like they're in France or Italy, and then I just go over with pencil on all the lines. That's the best way to describe it. You'd really just have to see the photos to see what they actually look like. I do a lot of face portraits too with that.
Right. What are you, like, what is the process? You have music on in the background? Are you sitting? Tell me, like, describe the scene for you as an artist during that creative process.
during that process. It's very long, so I definitely have to have music in the background. I usually put it on a speaker and just like jam out. and then I'm still living with my parents, so I'm usually in my basement by my room, and I have a desk set up, so I have like an easel down there for like larger portraits, and then my smaller ones, like the architecture ones, I usually just have like a little little setup for that.
How do you handle this notion of sort of celebrating your perfectionism and finding an outlet for that without sort of letting it get in your way? I mean, perfection, you talk about perfectionism in your artist statement. Many people consider that like a negative thing. And what's your relationship with your own perfectionist tendencies?
Well, I definitely think it can be a negative trait, but I like to see it as when I'm doing my art, I go through the process as best as I can. I want to make everything perfect, but the best thing is seeing it in the end and seeing how close I can get it to the actual product that I got it from, and just being able to look at the reference in the actual drawing to see how close I got and just be like, I tried my best to perfect it. And that's, you know, that's what makes me feel good as an artist, is to really think about that.
Yeah. Maybe precision is the word that I think people should think of when they look at it versus perfection. Although I don't know, sometimes you look at it, I'm like, dude, that's not perfection. I don't, in you know, in expression, I don't know what it is. What's next for you as an artist? Where do you want to go next?
Well, I'm going to college in the fall, so I'm going to SDSU in Brookings, and I'm going to pursue interior design as my major, but I definitely am thinking of minoring in studio art as I go to college, because I don't think I'm going to be able to just like give it up while I'm in college and focus on one thing, you know? Uh-huh. So I think I'm definitely going to have to take it with me and maybe try to get in more art galleries as I grow older, you know?
Yeah. Are you mostly self-taught? Did you take a lot of art classes at Stevens?
Well, I had taken like one in middle school, and then in high school I had like drawing, and I also was in advanced art. Yeah. And my teacher in there, Miss Coyne, she really helped me to practice more, and she helped me with a lot of tricks with like art. But besides that, I started before then, and I had just kind of self-taught.
Yeah. Well, I think Ms. Coyne would probably say, yeah, don't give it up, Vanessa, because I know it's such a gift and a rare thing to explore. Not everyone can do what you do. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On the
Thank
exhibition,
you so much.
And good luck at SDSU.
Thank you.
Vanessa Frank's solo exhibition can be seen in the gallery at the Dahl Art Center in Rapid City. It runs through August 13th. There is more information at the Dahl, that's DAHL, thedahl.org.